Hello world, it's me, Dennis. I've been a journalist and a talk show host for more than 45 years, and I've had the honor of interviewing many notable people in entertainment, business, politics, activism, and general interest. I keep a list of the top five people I would love to interview, and today that list is down to four, because my guest is Sue Gordon. Sue has served in a variety of leadership roles in intelligence organizations and disciplines, including 27 years with the CIA. Her final posting before retirement was as Principal Deputy Director of National Intelligence and a key advisor to the President and the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019. I first saw Sue on Nicole Wallace's MSNBC show, Deadline White House. I was immediately struck by her presence, her intelligence, her graciousness, and lucidity. I began researching Sue, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to meet her. Sue is the very model of great leadership and character, and her story is quintessentially American. Scrappy, funny, full of switchbacks, challenges, and opportunities as she rose to the very top of her profession. If you watch RSC, you know I love origin stories, and that is where Sue and I began on part one of our reasonably spontaneous conversation.
So I believe in origin stories too. I always tell people, and I often start by saying, we are who we began as, right? We are who we began as. And so I'm the third kid of a naval officer. Yes, I was born in Tennessee. My mom and dad's family are all from Tennessee. But I was only born there because my dad was a naval officer. And by the time mom was on her third kid, there was no way while dad was deployed, she could have a kid. So she went home to her mama and had me there in Tennessee. And then we promptly moved away to Boston. So my growing up is a year and a half everywhere. And we bounced back and forth across the country. I'm the youngest of three. That means I never got the window seat ever in my whole life. and Bob and Nan, my brother and sister, even though they had the window seat, would lean into me. Lean against the window. So they'd lean into me, so I'd lean forward. So I spent driving across country in the middle seat of the car, leaning forward, kind of looking at, you know, and talking to my mom and dad and watching the world go by. I was one of the lucky military kids who move often that it worked for me. I think it was a benefit to me. I learned how to put down roots fast, make friends fast, and take advantage of what we have. I think some who get transplanted a lot move at the wrong time, or just their personality is not one that works. But for me, it did. So Sue in high school, my brother's gone to college. We, for the first time ever, go to a private school in Norfolk, Virginia, starting in the middle of my 10th grade year. We had moved from Puerto Rico. My sister was in 12th grade getting ready to go to college. Norfolk public schools weren't the best, so mom and dad put their pennies together and sent us to a private school, mostly to help Nance have the foundation for her. My class is 89 people. So first time ever in a private school. We're kind of the weirdos because our doctors aren't real estate developers, lawyers, or doctors. We're the kid of naval officers. I never thought we didn't have money, but on an absolute scale, we were decidedly middle class. I'm a jock. I love sports. And sports the way my generation did, where, man, if you were a girl, there weren't a lot of organized teams. So if you love sports, you had to find the teams. Our parents didn't drive us to organize things. You had to find the pickup game and then find the league. And your parents didn't drive you there. You had to ride your bike there. So, man, I love playing. And that took over to high school. I have a couple IQ points to rub against each other. So I was also pretty smart. So I'm a happy, outgoing, nerdy jock. And it just worked, right? I made fast friends. I don't know that I had best friends. And I think that's probably one of the things that happens when you're moving a lot. But, you know, I'm still in touch with a lot of my high school friends. I felt close to them. And so and so that's me. I'm a happy kid that benefits from luck of landing there. It's a small school, so I get lots of experiences. I have a great, great English teacher who changed, I think, my life. First paper, I thought I was good. First paper I got back from her in 10th grade had more of her writing on it than mine. And so I think Mrs. Masterson taught me to be a good writer. My folks did a lot too, but she did a lot. And then I had great science teachers. And so just all my passions were developed there.
And so then so what made you choose Duke? Because Duke is it's a very good school.
It is. Duke first got on my radar. I said I'm the youngest of three, so my brother's 4 years older. When he started applying to colleges, Duke was one of the ones he was looking at. I remember, and I started looking at the brochures he looked at, and I remember Duke's just interested me. The pictures on the brochure, the chapel was on the cover, and I thought, Duke, that sounds like a good school. And then in high school, we were in Norfolk, Virginia, so big ACC country. So you start hearing about Duke and all the ACC, and so it fits. And it's a good academic institution, and it's a good sports school, and it's in the South. That kind of fits for me. It's a small school. It's only 5,000 undergraduates. And so, yeah, I know. Isn't that surprising? Sorry about that. So it just fit. Also, it turns out that I do pretty well on standardized tests, and I ended up being the valedictorian of my high school class. So back then, you hear stories now that kids that have my credentials are, you know, not getting into these schools. Back then, it was a pretty straightforward path in. I visited it and I fell in love. I think the kid and the school to this day pick each other, and we picked each other.
So you show up there. Now, let's just set a little for people that don't know. Title IX comes in 1972. So we're talking about an opportunity to be able to say that if you're going to spend a dollar on men's sports, theoretically, you're going to spend a dollar on women's sports. So we're going to have that. But that hadn't come in. So Liars. you arrive on campus. Do you have your basketball? And do you think, and then, because you're going into the sciences, and what's your perspective? Who do you think you are, and what are you doing there the first year at Duke?
Great questions. One of my high school coaches told me that I wasn't nearly good enough to play in college, so I should learn to be a ref. So I don't go to Duke with really expectations. You're right, Title IX hasn't kicked in really. There's no NCAA for women, and Duke certainly wasn't there yet. So not only was I not recruited, we can tell the stories of Duke women's basketball and how I was there during great years of growth, but there was nothing fancy about it when I went. I actually went to Duke in part because I wanted to be a marine biologist. And Duke had a marine science consortium on the East Coast that you could go to for spring semesters. And so I thought, okay, this is great. I'm going to go there. I'm going to become a world famous aquanaut. and that's how I go. So I go in with no particular expectation of playing sports. There was no recruitment going on. There was no notoriety. Varsity basketball for
no
women.
No scholarships. No. This stuff. No, that's not what is happening at that time.
It was
time.
Not. And varsity, I think Duke varsity women had only started in 75, might have been the first year. So I'm second year there. So that's how I go, you know, and I'm bouncing being on campus. And then it turns out that there's tryouts for women's basketball. And again, talk about how long ago it was, tryouts for a college D1 team. And I'm like, well, I play. Right. Cause I love playing, and I made it. you know, but you have to picture 76, where the way we get to the tryouts on the East Campus, not in Venerable Cameron Indoor Stadium, was we're sitting on a corner waiting for one of the juniors to pick us up in their beat up Dodge Duster to take us over there. And I don't even know if there were was a locker room where we played. The best part of this is it was on that first day of going to tryouts that a sophomore who was this tough New Yorker named Betsy Bergeron, we were sitting around talking before the girl picks us up in her car, and she says, we were talking about food, and she says, well, what's your favorite, you know, what's your favorite food? And I said, I like peaches, but I don't like taking the first bite because they're fuzzy. And she's, and I'm, look, I'm 18, but I look 12 and I have a Dorothy Hamill haircut. And she said, well, you do look a little bit like a peach, so we're going to call you Fuzzy. And from that day forward, first day of tryouts, I was called Fuzzy. And there are girls in their 60s now who call me Fuzzy. The Duke program knows me Fuzzy. And so that happened. So that's how we go over, right? I go, I have no expectations. I make the team. We are playing small schools like Guilford and Western Carolina, being driven in vans, staying four to a room, and we're 2-12 my freshman year. And I and the program grow up from there. I hardly played. My high school coach was almost right that I wasn't good enough to play, so I hardly play. I've tried to get my sophomore year, but now we have a new coach who's been brought in and four scholarships. And now we're on the big time. I make it again because you have to try out again. And this year we're playing kind of Duke gets the hint that basketball is big. So we start playing bigger schools and we have a bigger record. I mean, larger number of games. And we go 1-19 my sophomore year. In 1 week, we lost by 50 to Clemson, 70 to Maryland, and 82 to North Carolina State. Not that I remember the score of 125-43.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah. And then we just keep, and I'm elected captain that year. So I'm a sophomore who doesn't play enough to earn a varsity letter, but I'm the captain of the team. And then I make the team the next year. I'm captain again. We go 11-11. And then between my junior and senior year, the coach comes to me and she says, Fuzzy, I don't think we're going to be able to have a spot for you on the team this year because I need to bring in another recruited athlete. And I said, okay, well, how about if you let me come to tryouts and I'll see if I make your top 12. And I did. And so we're 14-13. We beat Virginia. We beat Carolina. And I end as the only three-time captain of the Duke women's basketball team, even though the only game I started was the pity game my senior year.
And this was, when we're talking about being the captain, we're talking about leadership, about what it is. What, I mean, could you see why, could you, are you getting why people followed you, why people wanted to have you and to have you at the head?
Well, I have no idea. And to this day, I'll still talk to my teammates, like, what were you thinking? They'll laugh at me. I think if I analyze it, mm-hmm. I think it's because I've always cared more about outcome than I care about myself. Right. I've always cared more about do we perform than do I look good or what I get. I don't think I have ever in my whole life been in it for me. And I think in part because you talk about the universe, I think I was gifted this belief that I had everything I needed, no matter whether I gave it all away. Mm-hmm. And so I think the attribute that made me maybe attractive and useful in this role was there's no one that works harder than me because you don't slough off. I'm adequately talented, so it wasn't like I was a detriment. But I would give everything to what the team needed. And so we had a 24-year-old coach and she couldn't figure out how to coach us. And so Sometimes I was the translator. Sometimes I was the buffer. Sometimes.
Exactly.
Right. Well, in other words, whatever was needed, I was willing to provide without needing to protect or get something for myself. Don't be confused. Like I'm like totally selfless. I hated not playing. I thought I had a chance to start once when we accidentally broke our center's nose in our opening huddle. I thought it was going to be my big chance, but Debbie put in someone else besides me. But I think if you ask what it is, it's and what I learned is that value is not equivalent to role. Right? You think that the people who have the most value are in specific roles. What I learned is no, there's value all over the place. And so
an incredible lesson to have. Now, academically, were you enjoying that rise? I mean, were the sciences, did the sciences really bite into you and you would see that, or how did that work?
Yeah, so I loved it. Duke was a great choice. You know, so many things. We did so much less research in the 70s about the school to go to. Really, I like Duke's name, so I chose it. That's almost true. But for me, so many lucky things happened along the way. Duke has very minimalist requirements. You have whatever department your major's in, you have to take the most courses, then you have to choose a secondary, a tertiary, and you have to take fewer courses and then fewer courses. So, but even within that structure, there's not a lot of specific requirements, with the exception of the things you have to take for your major. So it was a great place, once you satisfy the requirements, to also explore a whole bunch of other things. Even the big lectures were not big. And the craziest thing happened in my first biology course, freshman year, first semester. There were two professors who taught it. One taught basically very animal kingdom structure, phylum, genus, species. And then another taught more theoretical nature of life. How does it work? What are the interactions? I lucked into the latter, which is much more who I am. And, you know, we calculated the numbers of bits of information that would be required for spontaneous life, and then look at the probability that happened, or we look at evolution of the platypus. So it was all almost as though designed for how I think, which is fundamentally curious, asking questions. You learn enough foundation, but then you're like, well, what do I do with this? How do I think about it? And then I was assigned as an advisor, the chairman of the zoology department, an icon named Steve Wainwright, who was a functional morphologist. And so I went into functional morphology, which is how structure relates to function, which got me into math and engineering as applied to living systems. So I am enthralled with this. I take courses that are challenging in terms of how to think about things. And biology and zoology are such interesting disciplines because there's so much that's not known. Right?
Yes.
You have to induce the answers rather than deduce the answers, right? You have to look at what is, because evolution says that's perfect. And then you figure out, well, what the hell's it doing to look that? So there's just so much about my life that has been lucking into circumstance that fits with who I am. And then I guess the skill part on my part is saying, oh, let me do something with that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So of course, across my career, I'm taking more courses, more higher level courses, really going down the biomechanics and functional morphology track. So it's fun to say I'm a zoologist, but quite frankly, I'm the engineering of living systems gal. Yeah. But I take a bunch of other courses too. I love English. I take the Seafarer in literature. I love religion. I take the Old Testament. So Duke was such a great place for me because I got to do basketball I met the love of my life and I learned how to think. And so I come out the end of these 4 years, like just bouncy, bouncy.
And so, all right. So you meet, tell me his name.
Jim Gordon.
All right.
So you're in my age group. So you will say his name is James Gordon.
Yes.
So he's a Batman fan.
There you go. How could you not, right? All right. So you guys meet. What clicked? What clicked between you?
Well, he's super cute. He's a swimmer. And he's probably the smartest person I've ever met in my life. But the smart that translates into funny, the smart that doesn't take itself seriously. So we met because a friend thought I was living a pathetic life of only playing basketball and studying. So she set up a basketball game between nine guys and a pickup game with nine guys and me. And this swimmer joined as a late ad, and he asked me out that night. And I don't know. Life's been a ball since then.
Oh, wonderful.
Just had our 43rd anniversary.
So you're graduating. What are your thoughts when you're graduating?
So unlike every other Zoe major at Duke, I did not want to be a doctor, a medical doctor. So somewhere along the way, I thought, I was pretty sure I wanted to go get my PhD in biomechanics, but I also toyed with going to law school, and I took the LSAT because I love arguing. I love the intellectual discipline. So I thought, well, I'll go to law school or get my PhD. And then I thought, man, that's a really big gap. Like which one of those things? And so that's when the CIA was recruiting on campus, I decided to do an interview with the CIA. Because I thought, if I can't decide between those two, maybe you ought to go work for a little bit and figure out what you really want to do.
All right. So they were interviewing on campus. Now, I was reading when I was doing some research on you that the one of the things when you joined the CIA was that there was a long process of getting your clearances that was not the same for everybody. But you have what was going on there?
I don't know. It is a long process to get a clearance.
And everybody has to go through the entire process.
Everybody. Okay. And so I interviewed in my junior year, and it took about a year and a half to get my clearance, which made it so that I was offered the job after my senior year, and I started in that summer. No, I am the most boring woman in the world. So actually getting security clearances or keeping it has never been difficult for me. I'm boring.
So that had, all right. So you start at the CIA. And so one of the things that I'm very interested in culture. And what was the culture like in, you know, when you started there at the CIA? We're talking about very male-centric.
Yes.
Right? And because very few women leaders in senior positions that are there. So we're looking at this from that perspective. What are you looking at it from going on there? What's your sense of this organization as a culture when you arrived and began working in it?
Well, I don't know. So as I say, I'm the kid of a naval officer, and my father and the then director of the CIA had worked together in McNamara's systems analysis staff. So I kind of knew a bit about the CIA from him. You know, what you hear about the CIA is mostly about human operations. The CIA is mostly analysis, S&T development and support. And I went into the technical analysis business. So I don't know. I think the culture was exactly what you said. It's male dominated, particularly in the technical analytic and technical development disciplines. There were almost no women. I don't think I even really noticed it. Because if you're me, you've got a new job. And my job was not what I expected it to be. I got hired to do something, a job that would have taken advantage of my zoology. And that job went away before I arrived, and I had to find new work. So I find myself doing analysis of Soviet missile systems. Man, I had to get good at it. Right. So I don't think I had any time to notice that it was male dominated. I don't think I was daunted, just because almost everything was male dominated then.
You come from the military. Military at that time. Your father in the military at that time. We're not talking about women flying F-16s or any of that.
So I don't think that was daunting to me.
Right.
I also just, I think I started out being the same way I was at Duke, which is, okay, I caught the car. Now I better be able to do something with it. And so I worked at that. I will say, this is a terrible analogy, but it's one I've used before for the CIA, is being at the CIA was a lot like playing pickup basketball with guys. And when you play, women, if you watch the game and you play the game, it's very networky, right? You're passing the ball. It's very much about the system. But when you play pickup basketball with guys, what you learn is if you don't do something with the ball, you're not going to get it again. And that certainly was the CIA that walked into. But the other side of that coin that is much more powerful is the system is designed to let individuals do things. Think about that, right? So instead of being a culture that is jealous of people who get to do things or try and limit the success, this is a culture that expects success and expects people to do something. If you're here, you jolly well better be worth it. So what I walk into is with a work ethic, with a devotion to duty, a place that wanted me to go as far as I could go. And so I think that cultural aspect was just, again, to go along with my theme, just a lucky happenstance of a culture and a person who just fit really well. And if you look at my career, it makes no sense. And you can say, well, aren't you wonderful, Sue, because you were able to succeed in it. I think the better lesson to take away is how remarkable an organization it was that allowed performance instead of pedigree to dominate. No. Think about that, right? There's nothing about me that looked right. I wasn't an old white guy. I didn't have a degree in electrical engineering from an Ivy League school. I'm not someone that was looking to align myself with anything, and yet I was able to rise through the ranks. I think that's a remarkable statement on the culture and the organization.
One of the great things that I love, I mean, it's like when I watch women's sports, I love the idea because there's so much in the idea of the assist. Mm-hmm. And what a value if you can make someone else great, if you can give them an assist in order for them to score. I mean, was that the sense of the culture that you're talking about?
Yeah, because what you just said is right, because we scored. Right? We scored. Yeah. Like, I don't think there's any satisfaction in saying, well, we lost the game, but man, I did really well. Like, I just don't think there's any joy in that. And I also don't think there's any, if I give myself one piece of credit, it would be that I never protected myself. And so if I was given a job, man, we were going to go do it. And I never was like, oh, am I going to look good? Might I get in trouble? Could we fail? How will that relate to me? And mm-hmm. So I think the combination of an organization that just wants outcome and a person who's not trying to shape how you get there for any personal preference, for me, turned out to be pretty amazing in terms of what you could accomplish and what we accomplished.
How does pushing back look in that organization when there is either something is coming down that you're going, doesn't smell right, doesn't feel right? How does pushing back work in that so that you can do that?
So I think it has probably three elements. One, the organization has to have a culture akin to what we were talking about that is more invested in the right thing happening than it is in what it wants to happen or something else. So that's one. I think it requires individuals who own the space they occupy, but keep their and understand their responsibility for the bigger goal. And so are willing to say something when they see something that doesn't look like it's going to be right. So I think it takes an individual that feels enough responsibility for their job to say, okay, I now feel invested in the bigger job. I'm going to go ahead and say something. So I think it takes an individual willing to do that. And then you have to be a little clever where you not only have to be good about what the reason you're offering to say something, and you have to be brave enough to say it, stay in the conversation long enough so that you're sure they hear you, and then be willing to recognize that you are not the ultimate decision maker, right? Think about that. I mean, so it's the organization has to kind of want right, not just what it wants. The individual has to say, okay, I've got a role and I got to play that role and I'm going to screw up my courage because I have this role. And then the last is, but I can't be so impressed with myself that if I offer it and if it's heard and if it's rejected, that I don't start being disenfranchised, but I allow the possibility that I didn't know all that much. And so the CIA that I grew up in had the necessary conditions. And I think maybe the sports thing, maybe the sense of belonging to a team, maybe the hard work allowed me to both say it and accept it if it didn't go with me.
This episode of Reasonably Spontaneous Conversations has been brought to you in part by In Search of the New Compassionate Male. For more information, go to newcompassionatemale.com.